Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Well, good evening, you sick motherfuckers. Welcome to another episode of the Video Nasty Project. Tonight, our deep dive into the Section 3 movies continues as we take a look at Invasion of the Blood Farmers. Why don't you check out the trailer, and we'll be back in two shakes of a blood-covered lamb's tail to tell you all about it.
It's just a farmhouse and looks pretty innocent from the road. But once you're inside, you'll see what really happens on a terror farm. Invasion of the Blood Farmers. Coming in the dead of night, coming to plant the living and harvest the dead. Invasion of the Blood Farmers.
Within a week, the lab will be flooded with...
with human blood.
I can't stop it!
Are you strong enough? More raw terror, more stomach-turning shock than you can take. Therefore, we warn you, don't eat before you see Invasion of the Blood Farmers, and you'll have nothing to lose. Plant the living and harvest the dead. Invasion of the Blood Farmers, released by NMD Films, in color, rated PG, parental guidance suggested.
Alrighty, that was the trailer to Invasion of the Blood Farmers, which really doesn't have a lot of blood farming in it.
I thought it was going to be actual farmers harvesting things filled with blood from a lot of people. They're going to go down rows and there are going to be holes in the ground with amphoras or like bottles or balloons hanging from trees that look like misshapen pears or some shit like that. Some kind of, they're going to raise some kind of mutant creature from the dead.
You've just described the plot to Motel Hell, which exactly what happened, where they had the people buried into the ground up to the necks and they were siphoning the blood off for Farmer Farley's Fritters, I think it was.
I was very disappointed in watching the film that there wasn't, not only was there no pitchfork kills, there wasn't a pitchfork.
So why don't we actually tell them about the movie instead of telling them about the movie?
Okay.
So the movie is, okay, everything we are about to say is 100% true, and it makes no fucking sense. So the words coming out of our mouths are actually on the screen. So it starts out a zillion years ago at the dawn of Stonehenge when the druids ruled the earth or some nonsense like that. And it's got this voiceover from, it sounds like somebody doing a James Mason impression. And he's talking about how the druids are like one with nature and they've come from the heavens and they're going to, got this queen and she's in a box and they're going to resurrect the queen or something like that. And blah, 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 mystical mumbo jumbo.
The opening of this film had some really great potential. I mean, everything's blood red. The sky is kind of this reddish, you know, aubergine almost color in some areas.
And then we cut to the modern day of 1972, because that's when the movie came out. And there's this roadside bar. And the people in the bar are I don't even have words to describe the people.
They're too drunk to know they're not good actors in, and that they're not actually actors. They were probably people the directors said, come here, be a cop. You be a drunk.
Apparently, according to the trivia on the IMDb and on the extras on the DVD, everybody in this movie was paid in beer. So they were probably drinking their assets on site.
The actual guy behind the bar probably was the actual bartender who owned that bar.
So they have this dialogue going on with the patrons of the bar, and the direction they gave to the bartender was clearly, okay, laugh at something. And it has this cutaway of, like, the bartender laughing at something. And then the director says, okay, kind of react, kind of puzzled. And then they cut away to the bartender looking very puzzled. And is very clearly not at all related to what is being on the other side of what he's reacting to.
Yeah. So this guy staggering down the road, down this country road towards the bar. He's covered in blood, head to toe, his shirt, you know, and...
And somebody in the bar looks up and says, hey, that's old Jim Carrey!
Smokin'!
And he's staggering in and, like, just vomiting up blood and falls over and dies on the floor right there in front of everybody. And they're like, oh.
They completely play it off as this guy is the town drunk because, oh, here he comes. He's drunk again. And so they don't pay him any mind until he actually gets to the bar.
Yeah, when he's stumbling down the street, they just think, well, that's his ordinary way of walking.
He's covered in blood. He is literally covered, drenched in blood. Somebody took. He looks like fucking Kerry White at the end of Kerry. I mean, he's covered in blood. How do you not? Whatever. Okay, we're moving on. Moving on.
So this man may have been wed to this woman who's been hooked up to a clear plastic hose. Draining all the blood out of her into the centrifuge. And she's near the end. She is making all these noises like... And the overdubbed sound sounds like somebody with a straw or a small hose siphoning stuff like milk or yogurt into a styrofoam cup.
Meanwhile, the pumping machine is doing this ka-dook, ka-dook, ka-dook sound, which sounds exactly like when you have an oil can, one of them old, tiny oil cans, and you push on the bottom and it goes that da-dunk. It's that sound effect. So, yeah, no, the sound design in this movie, we've had great, glorious stuff like with Argento. This is not that.
Yeah, this is
about as opposite as you can get.
In fact, I'm not sure, but I think this film may have come out at the same year as Kiss Me, I think it's Kiss Me Deadly or Love Me Deadly, that had Lyle Wagner pre-Wonder Woman. And he's a supporting character. But in that film, there a young male prostitute gets kidnapped, taken to a mortuary, and drained in what has to be one of the most graphically vile scenes that I'd seen of that type. And it was actually terrifying. I really felt for that guy because he could act. There's no acting in this, so I felt nothing.
And so we then catch up with our obstinate hero of the piece and his fiancée. And this was the point where the movie, I realized this movie plays very much like one of the old 1950s creature features like Them or It Came From Another World and stuff like that. Because you have your rugged, good-looking, blonde, chiseled jaw hero and his female scientist sidekick. And they do science in throughout the movie while the aliens are invading or whatever. So it kind of plays like that, and that's these two.
They are on the verge of getting married. The boyfriend is kind of, you know, he's kind of in the science. He wants to go and work with a professor who happens to be the young woman's father. And they're out in front of the house, and she's saying, oh, come on, we're about to be married. Just give the science a break for a little bit. You know, just spend some time with me.
And that's when the mad scientist, the father, bursts out of the back door of the house. And... The acting in this movie is amazing. However, the acting in this scene, so he comes out and he's like,
where have you two been? Never mind. Come down to the lab. You won't believe what's happening.
Yeah, this is the scientist and the soon-to-be husband are the two, well, actors that I can discern in this movie. And the soon-to-be bride, she comes up a close third behind them. Everybody else, for my taste, my personal taste, no.
So the mad scientist and our chiseled, good-looking hero go down into the basement. And so they have these vials of blood. They drew samples from Jim Carrey.
The time for talking is over!
They've been analyzing all night long, and it's been growing. And so this little beaker that they started with, this little, you know, syringe full of blood, is now turning to this massive overflowing pot of blood. Well, blood.
Yeah, it has that weird kind of grape juice mixed with milk color.
Well, it's got that. Somebody dropped Alka-Seltzer in, because you have the Kensington Gore, and then you have this layer of fizz. Like, yeah. There's Pop Rocks in this or something.
They have to do something like that to make the blood grow. You know?
He says, it's growing. It keeps growing. It hasn't stopped since I started this.
And so the blood keeps growing, and they have to figure out this collagen, and they throw out some buzzwords that mean absolutely nothing. There's a string of word salad.
The reason the blood is growing is because of what's happening over in Druid Town.
Oh yes, we haven't mentioned the Druids yet, aside from the very beginning of the movie. So the Druids, they are trying to resurrect their queen, and what they have is this key, this kind of wrought iron key that's like covered over with like rust or something. And I guess they take the key and they use the key to test the blood. I'm thinking maybe like the thing where they stick it in the blood and something and it reacts. And if it reacts positively, then they can take that blood and resurrect their queen.
Most of the results they've been getting have been negative,
resulting in blown up Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
And then so the leader of the Druids is this guy named Crouton. And he is this absolutely camp. He's just camp.
You can tell that the actor's actual color is brown, but they've done something where they've slicked some coloring agent through so that his hair looks, it's like they tried to make it look gray, but it winds up looking kind of like frosted silver.
It's like what they did for Fuad in Blood Feast, where they took this, you know, 28-year-old dude and like frosted his hair, and it looks just about as convincing.
Oh my God, they needed Herschel to come in and act in this movie, because I think he would have been a perfect, you know, druid, you know, coming in and saying, we need more blood sample.
And then we get a couple of completely unrelated characters added to the script. You've got these newlyweds. They're staying in a motel, and they're like, look, this place has a television. And the man of the group, the husband, that's played by Michael Finley, the writer of this movie and the producer of 80% of Snuff.
He makes the mistake of going into the motel room without picking his wife up and carrying her over the threshold, which seems to be a theme here with this last two movies. And so she says, you're supposed to pick me up and carry me over the threshold. He says, shut up and get in here. You know, so he picks her up and, you know, carries her in and tosses
her. He does this terribly strange thing. Normally, you'd expect newlyweds to be like, the bed! And this is exactly what the woman does. She goes and she gets changed into a rather nice, skimpy little outfit.
Are you kidding? That's like 70s erotic. That is not... That turned me on. I found that scene very difficult to masturbate to completion on.
But at any rate, once she gets into the skimpy outfit and she just goes and pulls the covers back and lies down on the bed, and her husband is like, I need to take a shower. And I'm like, why?
And so she's like, oh, I'm going to go take the shower. And she goes into the shower and he like flips open the suitcase and like starts grabbing his jammies in like a really weird fashion. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, dude?
And he grabs the suitcase really quietly and before he opens it and, da-da-da-da, and then goes in there and she comes out and starts rifling through it while he's in the shower.
And this is a point where you can tell they have their priorities backwards, because instead of going into the shower with the woman, you follow Michael Finley into the shower and watch him shower. Wait a minute, why aren't we getting any titties in my exploitation movie? Okay, we get titties, but it's man titties.
And then, through the pebble glass, you see this, you know, shadow coming closer and closer, and...
And that would be the druid henchman, Egon, who comes in with this pimp's cane. like it was stolen from the Mac. And yeah. he comes in and like just taps Michael Finley very gently on the head. And then like there's this cut where like all of a sudden blood.
Yeah, it's like he took care of the wife in pretty much the same manner. You know, while she was in bed before she had a chance to scream, he's like, crack. And just like out. And it's just like, it must be Druid magic pimp cane.
It's gotta be, because any single person who gets thwacked on the head with this thing instantly falls down and has blood on their head.
But there is one occasion where he used it to savagely beat a person to death. It was just whacking and whacking and whacking away, if I remember correctly.
That would be when he loses the key. Well, what happens is, so Egon goes to observe the professor because the professor is doing nosy science stuff. And so he gets discovered and he has to run away. And then, like, the girlfriend's dog chases him into the woods. And then we get this cut of, like, it's all close up on Egon, and, like, they took, like, this IKEA bath mat and, like, rubbed it up against his face while they played, like, growling noises on the soundtrack, and he's flailing with his cane up against this bath mat, and then he whacks the bath mat with his cane, and there's a dead dog.
Yeah, like near a stream. And the water plays a role in this movie.
And that's where he loses his key, mm-hmm. which is the important component to resurrect the great goddess Beelzebub or whatever.
So this young fiance, she goes out, she leaves her father, says, I'm going to go find the dog. You know, he sounded like he was really hurt. He's saying, oh, he's probably just found, you know, just found something and he's making all this noise. But she goes out into the forest, wanders down to the brook and sees, you know, you know, sickness.
At the very end of the movie, Egon, like, recovers the key from the mad scientist.
The druids have their own pet scientist. He's one of their cult.
Well, which is secretly Crouton in disguise. All he does is put on a very nice suit, and apparently he knows the mad scientist's good doctor.
The doctor suspects him of lying to him about his intentions. You know, when it comes to, you know, the blood, he has all these vials of blood down the basement. He's doing his experiments and he has the reductive component that makes the blood go away.
Oh, yeah. And then Crouton's like, oh, I was examining your formula. Very fascinating. Oops. What? Oh, my. I've dropped it. And like the doctor's like, that's OK. We've got more. I'm like, did you not? What the? He just dropped your...
And Crouton, to his credit, kind of instantly recovers and says, oh, that's very fortunate. For you. I thought to myself, oh my god, this guy needs to be in an Ed Wood movie.
So Crouton goes away, and then young good-looking hero comes down into the basement, and they start talking about, like, the dog being missing, and, like, the reductive formula. And the guy that did the cinematography for this movie, he was the assistant camera operator, wound up doing the cinematography for Blue Velvet, and a bunch of David Lynch movies. Here, however, you have the doctor sitting in a chair, and you have good-looking scientist hero up here, and the camera can't decide which he wants to focus on. It's down here, and you see, like, the top of his head from his eyes and, like, the bottom half of the hero's, like, jaw. And then, like, it shifts up, and it's not this smooth, slow pan. It's just, like, boing, and it's up to the good-looking hero, but then the doctor is talking, and the good-looking hero is just standing there.
Obviously, this guy learned from his mistakes, because when you see the cinematography in most of the David Lynch films, it's actually pretty good. Whereas here, it's like, what was this, his first try or something?
Anyway, so the druids do druid things, the mad scientist does mad scientist things, and all of a sudden, at the very end, the druids kidnap the girlfriend, take her back to their lair. Oh my god, she's got the right blood type. Fantastic. Let's take her up to the cliff and we'll sacrifice her. So they take this pixie glass coffin with their queen up to this mountaintop thing, and they lock the camera down high and wide. And the director probably said, okay, queen, you lie in the box. Everybody, fight. And they just start fighting.
Yeah, The professor is, you know, firmly held, and then we've got our hero. He comes up, sees what's going on, and he rushes past one of the druids. Big mistake, because the guy's right there, and he comes by and grabs him.
But more importantly, we get no cutaways of this information. It's just one locked static shot. There are occasional cuts. They do some. But generally, it's just one and done.
By the way, this is insta-wake blood, the kind where you put on lips and instant dead, former dead.
And then there was the one druid. The one druid guarding the guarding the whole procession. So he's standing off in the corner, and he's got his torch, and he's holding his torch. And all of a sudden, like, the little rag blob at the top falls off. And he just, like, looks down. It sets, like, the bush on fire, and he's holding his stick, and he just kind of, like, puts his stick down and is like, that wasn't me. Yeah. I didn't do that.
And then he kind of demurs and then grabs the professor and tussles with him like nobody noticed he wasn't doing that the whole time.
And so good-looking hero, he comes running up and presumably he has the anti-blood stuff in like a syringe and like squirts it onto or into or injects the queen. I don't know because it's a long shot and we don't see shit. But then all of a sudden everybody falls over, dead, except for the heroes.
After all this shit, the boyfriend is kind of just nice and calm and said, oh, you've suffered a lot. Well, we've got through this. Like, seriously? You just escaped a fucking cult of evil druids and you're acting like you just went on a Sunday picnic and had too much cheese.
So, I apologize for the fact that we've gone through the entire plot and we're not really analyzing the plot because, as you might have been able to suss out, there's nothing here to analyze. There's just plot and stuff happening. And there you go. So, my friends, was this completely inoffensive movie nasty and seizable?
The gore that's in here is the kind of, like, poster paint splash on the face, on the neck.
The vivid red tempera paint color.
I kind of find myself at a loss as to why this is on the list at all. I'm assuming it's probably for the graphic cover art.
Well, that's hardly exclusive to this movie. I mean, yeah. I can think of 100 exploitation movies on my shelf that have things that over-sensationalize and...
Exactly. Yeah, this stuff was kind of par for the course, and I think that the sensationalism built up over this is people's minds going, but what is blood farming? I mean, what the hell? I mean, do they plant bottles full of blood in the ground, hoping to raise something? Are they balloons filled with blood they hang from trees to make it look like it's like blood oranges or some shit?
And honestly, this movie is not worth getting excited about. It's not. There you go. So we might as well just cut straight to the chase. Ashley, did you like...
Ugh, ick. Okay, so I consider this a case of a missed opportunity. There was so much what I consider, for me, padding in this movie with the scientist and the fiancé, soon-to-be husband, where they're talking about, well, the blood's doing this, and it keeps growing, and it's getting bigger, and, oh, you've got to see this! Come to the lab now! You, come here! And they could have done it in one or two scenes, but it seems like every 5 or 10 minutes they'd come back to it. And the same with the druids, you know, with them endlessly talking about raising their queen from the dead and stuff.
Because talking is much cheaper than special effects or action scenes.
Right.
There you go.
But you know the thing about film, show, don't tell. I always thought with the people they had on hand, which must have been like a dozen, 15 people, the costumes they had, they could have staged like a... ancient druidic ritual with rocks arranged around a fire and used everybody to full effect and had the queen. They had this woman dressed as a queen of the Sanguinista druids, have her doing something with the sky being red to give this whole thing what you want. You want to see her doing what she's reputed to be doing.
They kind of needed to, if you're going to have a threat, if you're going to have Chekhov's gun in the third act, you kind of need to fire it. And they didn't fire Chekhov's gun.
I thought it was terrible. It was complete dreck. But, on the other hand, it was fun dreck.
I will not disagree that this is a terrible, terrible, terrible movie. Incompetent, amateurish, unprofessional, barely they got the framing right, they've got the camera pointed in the right direction, and that's a plus.
The actors are following the script. Maybe.
But the thing is, I liked it. I found it just fun and entertaining. And this is very much has both feet firmly in the Ed Wood camp.
The characters, while kind of simplistic and definitely based on tropes, were also entertaining enough that I found myself sympathizing with them. I found myself liking these people. I even liked the villains, even though they were dreadful, stupid villains.
I think the smart way to sum up the movie is, depends on your tolerance for terrible, terrible cheese. If you like your Plan 9 from Outer Space, if you like your ghastly ones, if you like your blood feasts, then you're probably going to like this movie.
Sometimes stupid movies are fun, and there's some value to them. I will go to the ends of the earth to defend Sorority Girls and the Slime Bowl Bowl-O-Rama. It's a terrible movie, but it's also really entertaining. There's a lot of other movies that are like that. They're just campy fun. It's not really campy in the fact that they tried for campy. It just wound up being that way.
Oh, they played this movie completely and totally straight.
Well, that's how a lot of these movies end up being the way they are. I mean, they don't go for... When you go for deliberate camp, oftentimes you fall flat on your face because, as we all know, comedy is really hard.
It's an organic process. You can't capture lightning in a bottle and say, look, we're going to do a bad movie. Everybody's like, oh, you know, The Last Skeleton Cadaver is an awesome, great parody of the
movie. It's a great movie.
No, it's a piece of shit because it's not funny. It tries to be, look, we're being wacky. We're wacky. And you can't manufacture that. You have to capture bad movie essence by accident.
The thing is with me in this movie is this isn't a movie I could watch again for a while. I would have to come into it having forgotten some of the stuff, because if I see it again too fresh, I'll be honest, it wouldn't entertain me.
All right, so the split decision with a big asterisk on our side for you'll like it, but you bring some wine because this movie is nothing but cheese. So there you go. Well, thank you for spending a precious half hour of your life that you will never, ever get back watching us watch Invasion of the Blood Farmers. Next week, we're going to be watching The Killing Hour, which I guarantee will require only 28 minutes of your time to enjoy. So, join us here next week for that. In the meantime, email right here. You'll see it up. Boop. It's thevideonastyproject@gmail.com. Please send us a note. And y'all be staying evil.